Tonight, UMKC economics and law professor William Black on the line to talk economics and help ask for your support of this station. Stand by for Tell Somebody. Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter, at Tell Somebody Now. This is your host, Tom Clammer. If you have any comments or questions on the show, drop us a line at mail@tellsomebody.us. The podcast of last week's show with Mike Cadell of Radio Free Kansas has been posted. Go to www.tellsomebody.us and click on a tile for a link to a past show. On with the show. William K. Black, J.D., Ph.D., is Associate Professor of Law and Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Bill Black has testified before the Senate Agriculture Committee on the Regulation of Financial Derivatives and House Government Committee on the Regulation of Executive Compensation. He was interviewed by Bill Moyers on PBS, which went viral. He gave an invited lecture at UCLA's Hammer Institute, which, when the video was posted on the web, drew so many hits that it crashed the UCLA server. He appeared extensively in Michael Moore's recent documentary, Capitalism, A Love Story. He was featured in the Obama campaign release discussing Senator McCain's role in the Keating Five. Bill took the notes at that meeting that led to the Senate ethics investigation of the Keating Five. His testimony was highly critical of all five senators' actions. He is a frequent guest on local, national, and international television and radio, and is quoted as an expert by the national and international print media nearly every week. He was the subject of featured interviews in Newsweek, Barron's, and Village Voice. And I first heard of him years ago on 90.1 FM KKFI on the Heartland Labor Forum. Bill Black, are you with us?
Hello, how are you?
I'm better now that I hear your voice. How are you doing?
We're doing fine. We've just hit Minneapolis on the great drive up from Kansas City.
I really appreciate you taking the time while you're on a trip. So you're in Minnesota there with the Swedes and the Norwegians, yeah?
That's right.
Okay.
Looking for the Cone brothers.
Well, tell them Tom Clammer said hello if you find them.
Will do.
We are on a pledge drive, as you know, and Bill Black has graciously taken the time to help us ask for your support, which you can give us by digging out your credit card, picking up the phone, and dialing 888-931-0901, 888-931-0901, or go to www.kkfi.org and donate safely and securely there. But we also want to talk some economics tonight, and who better to do that than this economics and law professor and former bank regulator, Bill Black. And Bill, you sent me something the other day, and I have a question on another topic that I think might overlap with that a little bit. On Bill Moyers the other night, I think it was a rebroadcast, but they had Richard Wolff on, and talking about the financial crisis and so forth, he said he was not so much enamored of regulations as a solution to these kinds of problems, because in 30, 40, 50 years, the system will be manipulated to undo the regulations, and you're right back where you started from. And he also, for similar reasons, wasn't so enthusiastic as I believe you are on criminal prosecutions, because within the current system, bank CEOs and so forth are acting rationally. If they're corrupt, we need to totally redo the system. What's your response to that?
Well, it's pretty close to impossible to make a system in which bank CEOs can't make money by cheating. So I agree certainly with Richard on the difficulty. And I do emphasize that any war analogy is a bad analogy. This is not something that you can win for all time. The price is eternal vigilance when you deal with rich bankers. Now, we also agree that you need to change as much as you can the structure and the incentives. But you can't let off crooks because, you know, they weren't crazy when they looted. You know, they were just getting wealthy, right? That can't be a defense, or you'll never accomplish anything. What we can do that would dramatically change the incentives is to shrink the largest banks, right? It is insane to allow the roughly 20 systemically dangerous institutions. Now, these are banks so large that our own government is telling us that when the next one fails, and you notice I didn't say if, when the next one fails, it will cause a global systemic crisis. So why do we allow them to exist when they are at best ticking time bombs? And the really good news, and again, I think Richard would agree with this strongly, is that these banks are horribly inefficient. So we would have more efficient banks. We would avoid too big to fail and the perverse incentives that exist. And most of all, we would dramatically reduce kleptocracy, crony capitalism, the immense power of these places, if we were to forbid the existence of any systemically dangerous institution. And the way you would do that is, first, stop them from growing. Second, tell them within 5 years they have to shrink to below $50 billion in assets. And three, ultra-intensively regulate them during that five-year period. And that's when you need to bring in people with a track record of success in regulation. Again, Richard is right. Over a 30-year period, you're going to have a number of bad regulators, weak regulators. But if they don't have to deal with the systemically dangerous institutions, even when the regulators are weak, you don't cause this kind of global crisis that we've seen.
And in terms of the rationality of bank executives within the system, does this sort of connect, am I right, with your most recent post at neweconomicperspectives.org, Roger Meyerson's Paon to Plutocracy?
It does, and it actually, to me, shows one of the ones with Richard's analysis that you just gave, because it's the analysis that the economists give that blow up the system. They say bankers act perfectly rationally, and that the incentive of the bankers is to cheat and steal and shirk, and therefore we need to change that incentive, and the way to change that incentive is to bribe them massively, and I mean to the tune of billions of dollars. And Meyerson, and trust me, he's not being ironic, says that the great advantage of capitalism is that we have billionaires, and that you can, since you can only trust billionaires to run banks without looting them, we have the best system. Now, of course, this is insane, right, on multiple levels that we've just gone through. But people get to be billionaires in many cases by cheating. And once they are billionaires, they don't stop cheating. They use their power to be able to commit crimes with complete impunity, which is what we have now under the Obama and the Bush administration between them. Again, savings and loan crisis, about 1/70th the size of the current crisis. Just in cases designated as major, we get over 1,000 felony convictions. And to do that, our regulatory agency, just our agency, makes over 30,000 criminal referrals. This crisis, 70 to 80 times bigger, same agency, makes zero criminal referrals. And as we speak, no major banker that drove this crisis has even been indicted, much less tried and convicted. So, you know, if you crush regulation, you also crush prosecutions, because the only way the FBI is going to learn about these cases and be able to get the detailed evidence to bring a case, because, of course, these guys will spend money like water and hire the best criminal defense lawyers in the world, is to have the regulatory agencies make it a top national priority to prosecute, which is what we did. And we had, by the way, a 90% conviction rate in these elite fraud cases against the major bankers. That can be done again. And so I would make, you know, don't give up, folks. Insist on different leadership that is actually going to make bringing these cases a priority, is actually going to make regulating the banks as opposed to doing their will a major priority as well.
Okay. And, Bill, you were talking about the prosecutions in the savings and loan crisis compared to what we've got now, and some pretty interesting numbers related to that. Why is it possible politically for these prosecutions and investigations to have been possible in your day as a regulator, and why is it possible to not do that now without some kind of a outcry?
Well, it is possible. You know, if you go back in time to, say, 1984, 1985, there were virtually no prosecutions then. And people were saying, oh, it can't be crime. You know, bankers don't commit crimes, until we dug into the facts and made the criminal referrals and got the prosecutions and showed that, yeah, actually that was. And what happens is you create a drumbeat. We not only have these 1,000, and again, this is just the elite criminal prosecutions, over 1,000 successful felony prosecutions. We also had over 3,000 administrative enforcement actions, and we had about 800 lawsuits and such. And the combination of all of this meant that there was a constant drumbeat in the media, in the national media, but also in the regional and local media, where you would read against about criminal fraud scheme after criminal fraud scheme, and about people being indicted, and you'd have pictures of the guys being arrested, and then you'd have more stories when the trial came and the juicy stuff came out, more stories when they were convicted, often a story when they were sentenced, sometimes a story when they actually were sent to prison and such. So you create your own momentum after a while once you're successful. But if you don't start with the regulators, you don't get there. Because here's the obvious thing, except it doesn't seem obvious to the current and last administrations. And that is, CEOs don't make criminal referrals against themselves.
Right.
So it's got to come from the regulators. On the absolute best day, and we don't have many of those, we have about 2,300 FBI agents that do white-collar investigations. We have over 1,300 industries in the United States. That means there are fewer than two FBI agents, not per company, per industry. Wow. So they, you know, two things immediately. One, they obviously can't have expertise in the individual industries. That's impossible. And second, they can't walk a beat or they'd never find anything. So FBI white-collar specialists have to be in their office waiting for criminal referrals, which are never going to come from the bank itself. It can only come from the regulators. And so the current leadership of the regulatory agencies, and this has been this way for over a decade, has decided to eliminate the criminal referral process. And that's like saying, hey, guys, you know, in the old days, come into our town, rob the bank, nobody's going to stop you and such. Well, people will rob banks in those circumstances, and that's what we've done right now, except that, of course, CEOs can steal a whole lot more than any of those guys with six shooters in the old days.
Indeed. And just by the way, and if you missed the beginning of the show, this is Tom Clammer. You're listening to Tell Somebody on KKFI, and we're talking to William K. Black, UMKC economics and law professor, former bank regulator, enforcer, whatever the title was, and author of the best...
Many different titles.
Yeah. And author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. I have a copy of that book right here in my hot little hands. And thinking about the relationships between the regulators and the regulated these days, as opposed to, say, in 1987, where, as in Appendix C in your book, titled Get Black, Kill Him Dead, I read... photostat of a memo that says to Jim Grogan from Charles Keating Jr., subject, highest priority, get black. Good grief. If you can't get right in Congress to get black, kill him dead. You ought to retire. And I assume he was speaking figuratively there on the desire to kill you, but it's a little more friendly relationship generally these days, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, no one has had any need as a crook to go after the regulators because the regulators are the best buddies in the modern era. But back in the day, Keating, who was the most notorious of savings and loan frauds, hired private detectives twice to investigate me. Sued me for $400 million in my individual capacity and tried very hard and came very close to getting me fired. And the right referred to there is Speaker Wright, who was, of course, Speaker of the House and one of the most powerful elected officials in all of America and a strong ally of Keating, along with the five senators that you started out with the introduction, who became known as the Keating Five and such. And again, you haven't really had to, as a crook, get Congress to intervene on your behalf and get the regulators off your back very much because the regulators haven't been there. And that's for a good reason, and that tracks what you said earlier about the Heartland radio program. So the really pernicious stuff, and this stuff is planned, is to deliberately create a competition in laxity. You put the regulatory agencies in competition by threatening to move, say, the banks to the City of London out of Wall Street. And you say, we're going to go wherever the regulation is weakest. And so right now, the City of London political leader, the mayor, is actively competing for weak regulation. And similarly, we have a competition, a race to the bottom in Missouri and Kansas, on taxes, especially taxes on businesses, where the dynamic of the competition lead you to getting no revenue, zero revenue, from businesses. In fact, it leads you to get negative revenue. In other words, you give them tax subsidies and grants and such in addition to not collecting taxes from them. So the businesses deliberately put the states in competition with each other by threatening to move their businesses. This is completely pernicious.
Yeah, and then you end up with John and Jane Doe living in a food desert, paying outrageous levels of sales tax on food to cover the difference.
That's right, and they deliberately target workers, of course, because what they also say is we want a state with so-called, you know, right-to-work laws, anti-union laws designed, again, quite deliberately to destroy unions.
Yeah. Well, Bill Black, we, I think, want to maybe get another message out of the way. Give a listen to this, and we'll get back to it.
Why should you support KKFI? Hear what these listeners have to say.
This is KKFI. It must be. They play the grooviest rockabilly mood swing music ever in the world. Right here in Kansas City.
KKFI gives me a human connection to the world and brings a light to a vehicle to illuminate critical issues that affect all of our lives. KKFI is an integral part of there being a great connection between people and events and musicians and artists, and they play a great role in this community. Support KKFI.
KKFI, to me, is multicultural education. You have so many different cultures that you broadcast their music, and it's just always a treat.
If you haven't made your donation yet, do call into our pledge line at 888-931-0901. It makes all the difference. We depend on you. Once again, that number is 888-931-0901.
Okay, 888-931-0901. You're listening to Tell Somebody, and we're on the phone with Bill Black, who's taking time to get on the phone even while he's on the road in Minnesota. Bill Black, I am a supporter of the contention that media kind of define the realms of political possibility, and the major media are, I believe, part of the problem in what's politically possible these days. I'm very biased towards community radio, and even apart from this smokescreen about liberal versus conservative, I really believe the most easily accessible, reliable information, whatever your political persuasion, it comes to me on community radio, even more so than NPR and PBS. But we don't have huge listening numbers. Are we just wasting our time? What do you think about all that?
Well, I agree that the main media is always late on the stories. As I said, once you get things rolling, actually they sometimes jump on the bandwagon and become pretty successful. But the only reason they're ever going to do that is because of places like KKFI. And so, no, you know, first there is great importance and honor in being a voice in the wilderness when much of the rest of the world is crazy. But second, no, this is how things get public. And indeed, you're seeing with this recent stuff on national security that, again, critical to this was one sort of mainstreamish, The Guardian, in terms of the United Kingdom, but very much non-mainstream in terms of Glenn Greenwald and such, voices that you didn't used to hear. And independent radio is one of those great sources But of course, it does more than that. It is local. And it, as you say, it transcends all this liberal versus conservative. It's simply this area. You know, what are the things of concern to people in this area? Which is something, of course, you're not going to hear very much in the flyover states when you talk about national media. They often think that we're kind of quaint if they think about us at all on either the left or right coast. But local radio here, it's by people here, interested in global issues, certainly, but interested in local issues as well, and interested in how all of these issues affect the people of this region.
So we have Elizabeth, who has called in and made a donation, and Marlon Beach, a longtime supporter of this show and KKFI. In a nutshell, you don't think they're wasting their money calling in with a pledge, and you'd recommend others to do so? Am I putting words in your
mouth? Absolutely. And given all the things we do with our money, it's actually probably one of the best things that we can do. And the nice thing is you can do whatever makes sense in terms of your income and your, you know, needs as well. And certainly don't want to take money that would go to the kids going to the dentist, but if you're in a position to do more, and whenever you're in a position to do more, great as well. So it's all greatly appreciated, whatever size, and it's one of the things that keeps America, important parts of America, alive.
Well, if you're listening out there and want to do like Elizabeth and Marlon Beach did, pick up the phone and dial 888-931-0901. Bill, shifting gears here a little bit, one of the things that just seems to get hammered over and over and over again in the mainstream media is the need to reform entitlements, a word that just really kind of gripes me sometimes, because I think the big entitlement problems are the 1% feeling entitled to do whatever they want at the expense of the rest of us. But they're referring to Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. We've got fixed the debt. I'm recently succumbed to signing on with Twitter, where you can hook up with people that you want to see when they write something. But one of the wonderful benefits is that with Fix the Debt, they've paid to promulgate their tweets, and I don't even have to sign up. I get all this information from them that all these problems are with the sequester and little people getting hurt are because we haven't fixed entitlements. Could you talk about that subject a little bit?
Sure. So the things that they're targeting are the things that drive them crazy, and they drive them crazy because they work so well. So if you want something that has transformed America and taking it from a situation where to be old was to frequently, I mean more frequently than not, to be sick and to be impoverished. That would be Social Security. So it is what has made America vastly more humane, and it also means that we can do all kinds of things and take all kinds of chances with our jobs. Right? We can go, we can try a different job, we can move. Americans move more than pretty much anybody in the world, certainly in the developed world and such. And all of this is actually very good for the economy. So by providing security in our older age, we allow people to take more prudent risks when they're younger, and that includes when they're in their 40s and 50s and 60s, by the way. And all of that makes our economy hum. So Social Security is a completely made-up crisis. Right? There's absolutely no reason that people don't need to get paid in full from Social Security, and it doesn't take any expenditures remotely as large as our wars. to do all of these things. So that one's just made up. And you know, as I said, that they're attacking it because it works so well. But by the way, they're also attacking it for another reason. There are all these front groups created by Wall Street, and their great goal is to privatize Social Security because they want to get the investment fees of investing trillions of dollars of retirement savings. And if we ever did that, that would give them hundreds of billions of dollars of additional income and make all of us riskier as well, by the way. So that is their great dream, and they are behind the scenes in most of these efforts. Whatever their nice names and such, it's Pete Peterson, Mr. Wall Street, a very conservative Republican, and he's quite open in the past when he was less cautious about this goal of privatizing Social Security. Now, the second one is programs like Medicare and Medicaid, and there are problems with health expenditures in the United States, and that is that we spend roughly twice as much as the rest of the developed world as a percentage of GDP on health, and we get essentially the same outcomes, in many measures slightly inferior incomes, for spending twice as much money. And that's because we do this through private health insurance companies. And they, you know, they see all these complaints about government, bureaucracy. Nobody's a bureaucrat like private health insurance. And, of course, they don't just say no. They say no a lot, so they collect a lot of money on the premium, and then the game is to try to deny, coverage, of course. And so they're particularly pernicious, and at any time, we can go and follow the model of all these other developed nations in Europe and cut our healthcare costs by about half and have just as good of healthcare. So that's not a problem of Medicare and Medicaid. That's a problem of the private sector. And let me say something there again. All these things come from straightlining and saying if nothing changes over 30 years, then healthcare will be this monster if we just take its growth rate and extrapolate it for 30 years. And, of course, that would be true. If you take anything that's growing at roughly twice as fast as GDP and you go 30, 40, or 50 years out, it becomes a monster that eats everything, which is, of course, why it doesn't happen in the first place. But second, long before Medicare and Medicaid would be in trouble, every private company in America that provided health insurance would be unable to compete internationally if healthcare costs keep going up massively greater than all of our competitors, because most of our healthcare is still provided through private folks. And so the GMs and the Fords would be completely uncompetitive if healthcare expenditures are allowed to increase massively for another 40 years in this fashion. The third critical safety net program is food stamps, which is now called SNAP, Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program. And that one is utterly obscene, right? Unless you want people to starve to death or have kids to be malnourished, which is incredibly stupid because it costs you far more money given the problems that malnutrition causes, then you need to pay for this. And if we didn't have food stamps, I mean, you know, step back. Why do we have this huge increase in food stamp usage? Because we had the Great Recession. And if we had not had this safety net of food stamps, you literally would have had over 10 million American kids suffering from malnutrition. That would be insane. And so the current attack on the food stamp program is not only economically stupid, it is the most vicious act of these politicians yet.
Yeah, and didn't some big ag bill just pass in the last day or two that gives lots of SNAP to big agriculture and at least some cuts to SNAP for real people?
Yes, that's what I'm referring to.
Yeah, just happened. Once again, we're talking to Bill Black on Tell Somebody on KKFI. We are in pledge drive mode, and I want to thank a couple more people that got into the spirit of things. Jack Poteet, again, another longtime supporter of the show. Thank you very much, Jack. Good to hear from you. And Mary Lindsay with Reclaim Democracy and Kansas City chapter of Move to Amend the Constitution to Overturn Citizens United, local chapter of a national group that's getting some traction these days. Thank you both very much for calling. And the number once again is 888-931-0901. You can also go to kkfi.org and click on a donate button safely and securely. And this show is in a victim of austerity in terms of show-specific premiums, I'm afraid. You just have to have the love in your heart and pony up the money. But any station-wide, if you donate $90 or more, you can get a KKFI T-shirt, the latest edition of that. For $150, if you're a music fan, you can take an hour and pick the music on your favorite KKFI music show and try making that deal with your favorite corporate music radio station programmed out of Texas or Pennsylvania or New York. They'll either laugh you out the door or they'll call the cops, but you won't get the deal like that you get here. $150 for the guest DJ, $200 you get the T-shirt and the guest DJ, and whatever level you donate, you get the satisfaction of knowing that you're supporting your community radio station and make Bill Black feel like his time was well spent, which I hope will be the case. There's you're associated with the what some refer to as a kind of anti-Chicago school of economics, the Kansas City School, MMT, Modern Monetary Theory at the UMKC School of Economics. Can you talk about that just a little bit?
Sure can. Let me do just 30 seconds thanking Mary, who I've spoken for as well in a couple of times, but linking it to our stories. It's very much Citizens United that has exacerbated all of the problems we've talked about, because it allows these secret front groups to be massively funded by these Pete Petersons of the world and such. And they do target regulation. They target any state that has pro-union laws. And, of course, they target all of the safety net for destruction. So I wanted to bring that together. So modern monetary theory is a area of macroeconomics, which means the big picture things like unemployment and inflation rates and such. And it's quite true that my colleagues who are macroeconomists, I'm most assuredly am not, are some of the world's experts in the development of modern monetary theory, which, by the way, Paul Krugman has acknowledged that those folks, in other words, us folks, my colleagues, ended up being much more accurate about their understanding of what would happen in terms of stimulus not producing any significant inflation than he was. And so modern monetary theory does a bunch of things, but one of the things it says is it's critically different whether your nation has a sovereign currency. So the United States has its own sovereign currency. Nations that join the euro give up their sovereign currency. And when they give up their sovereign currency, they give up a big aspect of what it means to be a sovereign nation. And so one of my colleagues, who's the chair of our department, Stephanie Kelton, long ago, before the euro started, predicted that it was going to cause a severe problem. And one of the specific things that she was writing about is, so what's going to happen if the periphery of Europe goes into severe recession and the core nations are not in anywhere near as severe recession? So there are typically three ways you can get out of a really bad recession, and these ways are not mutually exclusive. You can do all three of them at the same time. One thing that you can do is have a big stimulus program fiscally. Another thing is you can have an aggressive monetary policy, a rapid expansion of the money supply. And a third thing you can do is devalue your currency. But if you join the euro, you can't run big deficits because it's illegal to run big deficits. Now, that doesn't stop them, but it means that you can't do it proactively to try to solve problems. You could only stumble in it disastrously. And you can't have an aggressive monetary policy because Germany controls the European Central Bank, and Germany still has this fixation on Weimar and hyperinflation, and so it never allows any aggressive monetary policy. And, of course, you, if you're Greek, you can't devalue your currency because you don't have a currency anymore. Right? You don't have the drachma. You don't control it. And, again, the Germans aren't about to allow a devaluation of the euro. And so what's left? Well, what's left is of really big interest, I hope, to listeners of this station, especially anyone who listens to the labor coverage, because what's left is to run a race to the bottom again. And this race to the bottom is on wages. So if you're in Ireland, what you're doing, and an Irish conservative authority, by the way, their labor party is their spectacularly anti-labor party. It's kind of interesting. A bit like the Democratic Party becomes at times. Anyhow, they are eager to reduce working class wages in Ireland so that they can outcompete the Spanish. But the Spanish are eagerly trying to cut the wages of their workers to outcompete the Portuguese, who are trying to cut their wages to outcompete the Greeks, who are trying to cut their wages to outcompete the Turks. And we call this the Road to Bangladesh strategy.
Right.
So this is pure madness. This is austerity. But austerity doesn't just mean austerity. It means quite a deliberate assault on the working class and labor unions. And so that is going on throughout the euro system. And as a result, and again, this is predicted by modern monetary theory, this austerity has gratuitously put the eurozone back into recession. The numbers just came out at 12.2% unemployment for the eurozone as a whole, which is 60% higher than in the United States. But youth unemployment is through the roof. In Greece and Spain, if you're under 25, your chance of being and in the workforce, or attempting to be in the workforce, your chance of being unemployed is more than 50%. And that means that enormous numbers of young men and women, as soon as they get their university degree, check to see that their passport is current so they can emigrate. So Europe is taking many of its best and brightest and telling them you have to leave your country. And this is going to cause long-term damage to the entire periphery. It'll help some of the core, of course, who will get all these eager college graduates who, of course, are reducing wages in Germany and France and the United Kingdom as we speak. But all of this has simply created an additional, much deeper recession, except that it isn't a recession if you're in Spain or Greece or if you're at all young in Italy. We're talking about Great Depression levels of unemployment. In fact, we're talking about unemployment levels that are considerably higher than the average in nations like France in the Great Depression era of 1930 to 1938. Indeed, France's unemployment right now, and France, of course, isn't remotely as bad as Greece, Spain, and Italy. France's unemployment right now is higher than the average unemployment in 1930 to 1938 in France.
Wow.
So we have brought back the Great Depression in not all of Europe, but an important portion of Europe. And we did it utterly gratuitously through this stupid austerity principle, which is economically illiterate.
Okay, and I just want to slip in quickly here, thanks to Terry Bunker, another longtime loyal supporter of his community radio station. Thank you, Terry. And don't blame me, I voted for Terry Bunker. And thank you, Joe and Corliss Jacobs. And the note says they want Tom and Bill Black to know we appreciate them. That's what we want to hear. Thank you very much. And if you want to join them, the number is 888-931-0901. Bill, we're getting down to somewhere in the neighborhood of a five-minute home stretch. And, you know, some of this just makes so much sense about, you know, if you, this austerity, if you don't have consumers who can buy things, which is, you know, greater than two-thirds of GDP over here, it makes sense you're not going to get out of a recession by cutting government spending and employment. But things making sense, I think, is a little dangerous because it makes sense to balance your checkbook, just like we do at home. Some of this, especially what your colleague Stephanie Kelton gets deeply into about deficit and debt, doesn't just come from common sense. You need to have a little more sophisticated understanding. I'm curious, what do you know, I went to business school at UMKC and rocketed through a four-year program in 18 years, and I had a couple of semesters of economics that kind of deepened my conception that I don't really know anything. What kind of education is a typical person that isn't an economics PhD getting in economics, say, at UMKC, and is there hope there?
Well, it certainly is at UMKC, but it's probably true that the business school folks have a very different view on some of these issues. But overall, when they do surveys of professors, there's actually quite a consensus against austerity in the range of over three-quarters. Well over three-quarters of professors of economics, and that includes lots of very conservative people. So this is one where we actually have been winning the intellectual argument even with very conservative economic professors, not all of them, but a big chunk of them. And you're quite right that one of our biggest problems is, well, what do we all know, right? We don't know economics. We know our daily life and our daily budget. And for us as individual consumers, we can't be running big deficits forever and such, right? We've got to, as you say, balance our budget. We understand that we can borrow money earlier in our careers to buy a house and such and to get an education. But we want to be very conservative about credit card debt. I mean, that's really good advice. In fact, here's the consumer education part. If you can, pay down your high balance credit charge bills right away with any extra money you have after donating to KKFI.
After, that's
okay,
right.
So back to the chase. So that's what we know. We know our own household budgets. And the key is that a nation ain't nothing like a household budget. At least a nation with a sovereign currency isn't anything like it. And you can tell that from just plain history. And that's one of the other things that my colleagues do is and others that do modern monetary theory, have actually looked. And it turns out, for example, that we have run a deficit about three-quarters of the time in America over our history. And the only times, there are about seven periods where we substantially brought down the deficit, and six of them were followed by depressions. And the seventh was followed by the Great Recession. All right, so again, we aren't just the same, and people can look at new economic perspectives at the work of a number of folks, but in particular Randy Ray, my colleague Randy Ray, who is recognized as one of the world experts in this, along with Stephanie Kelton, in which he has really good primers that take folks through in a very understandable fashion. So if you want to get educated, and we really encourage people to get educated on all these issues, in addition to listening to this station, take a gander at New Economic Perspectives. It's free and actually painless.
Okay, well, Bill Black, the time has slipped away much too quickly for my taste. I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the air. We'll have to about leave it at that. Thank you very much. And once again, neweconomicperspectives.org. Check it out. And the number is 888-931-0901. And we got to go.
Thank you, and thank all the listeners.
Oh, and thank Carol Hughes. Just got another note, another longtime dedicated supporter. Thank you, Carol. We'll see you next week. Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send me an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @tellsomebodynow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody, heard Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Central Time on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook, Twitter, email list, or any other way you can think of. Big thanks, as always, to Neela Farmovahedi. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next week on Tell Somebody.